Give Us This Day Evening Edition is a devotional reflection upon the New Testament lesson from the Order for Evening Prayer from the Book of Common Prayer 1928. These reflections are written and presented by Father Charles Erlinson, who serves at the Church of the Good Shepherd Reformed Episcopal Church in Tyler, Texas.
Today is Tuesday of the eighth Sunday after Trinity. The lesson is taken from Acts chapter 26, verse 24, through chapter 27, verse 8.
And as he thus spake for himself, Festus said with a loud voice, Paul, thou art beside thyself, much learning doth make thee mad. But he said, I am not mad, most noble Festus, but speak forth the words of truth and soberness. For the king knoweth of these things, before whom also I speak freely. For I am persuaded that none of these things are hidden from him, for this thing was not done in a corner. King Agrippa, believest thou the prophets? I know that thou believest. Then Agrippa said unto Paul, Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. And Paul said, I would to God that not only thou, but also all that hear me this day, were both almost and altogether such as I am, except these bonds. And when he had thus spoken, the king rose up, and the governor, and Bernice, and they that sat with them. And when they were gone aside, they talked between themselves, saying, This man doeth nothing worthy of death or of bonds. Then said Agrippa unto Festus, This man might have been set at liberty, if he had not appealed unto Caesar. And when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band. And entering into a ship, Adramidium, we launched, meaning to sail by the coast of Asia, when Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. And the next day we touched at Sidon, and Julius courteously entreated Paul and gave him liberty to go unto his friends to refresh himself. And when we had sailed from thence, we sailed under Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. And there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and he put us therein. And when we had sailed slowly many days, and scarce were come over against Sindus, the wind not suffering us, we sailed under Crete, and over against Salmone. And hardly passing it, came unto a place which is called the Fair Havens, nigh whereunto was the city of Lycia.
A little learning is a dangerous thing, they say. In this case, I figured out who they are. Alexander Pope. Well, I have a little learning, especially when it comes to New Testament Greek. This is, of course, no fault of my Greek teacher. He knows who he is. My little Greek, I keep him in a closet in my house, cannot help me make a firm decision about the very verse I want to discuss today, Acts 26:28. I could cut the Gordian knot and simply go with God's version of the Bible, the good old KJV, which reads, Then Agrippa said unto Paul, Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. Young's literal translation has it, In a little thou dost persuade me to become a Christian. The New American Standard Version says, You almost persuade me to become a Christian, while the English Standard Version puts it, In a short time would you persuade me to be a Christian? We're used to thinking that Agrippa is sane, that Paul has him on the ropes, and that if he continues, Agrippa may become a Christian. I've even extrapolated the text to mean possibly, that the reason Agrippa stands up and gets ready to leave is that he doesn't want to be persuaded any further. But I have in mind today an alternative understanding. What if Agrippa really is asking Paul something like, Paul, did you really think you could persuade me to become a Christian in such a short time? Did you really think that I, a Herod, remember, could be so easily persuaded? Have you heard the rumors that I'm living like incestuously with my sister Bernice? Even the great St. Paul, in his longest recorded speech, couldn't persuade Agrippa to become a Christian. It appears as if he may not even come close, in spite of some translations that may suggest so. We want to believe that it would come so easily. We want to believe that people usually give their life to Christ in an instant without having previously heard of or considered him. But ironically, I think that in so thinking we give too much credit to man and not enough to God. Such thinking easily shades into believing that it is the persuasiveness of our words or the earnestness with which they are spoken that will convert men to Christ. And so we pat ourselves on the back when someone moves towards Christ and kick ourselves for not being clever enough if they don't convert in our time with them. 5 minutes later, imagining some devastating comeback that would almost certainly have converted them, if only we thought of it at the time. We give too much credit to both the one who bears witness to Christ and the one who responds. Far too often, we don't remember or see all of the invisible work that God has been doing in that person's life, usually without us being involved at all. I want to look at three of the most famous examples of immediate conversions, in which people are converted in an instant. The first is St. Paul himself. Certainly, he is the epitome of the instantaneous, miraculous conversion, and perhaps the source for much of our thinking on the matter. So important is this example that St. Luke records it three times. Originally in chapter 9, and then when Paul relates his conversion to the Jerusalem Jews in Acts 22, and to King Agrippa II here in Acts 26. And yet, what else do we know about this instantaneously converted Saul? We know that he knew a lot about Yahweh. He was, remember, a Pharisee of Pharisees. He had and knew the law. He was zealous for God, as he incorrectly conceived of him. He was also the recipient of the miraculous that very few of us would ever dare to claim. Surely Jesus Christ had been working in Paul's life long before he smacked him down on the road to Damascus. Paul himself certainly thought so, for he thought of himself as elect before the foundations of the world, and Paul himself spent years studying even after conversion. A second dramatic example of an apparently instantaneous conversion is the conversion of 3,000 people on the day of Pentecost. No faithful Christian would deny the miraculous nature of what happened on Pentecost, but look again at the 3,000 who were supposedly spontaneously converted. These were not 3,000 African animists, but 3,000 faithful Jews who loved God and had come to Jerusalem to worship him at the appointed feast day. Yes, they needed to be converted to Christ, but look at how God had already been working in their lives and blessing them. Third, think of John Newton of Amazing Grace fame. Many of us have heard of his dramatic conversion to Christ from a sinful life as a slave trader. Until he was 7 and his mother died, he had been raised with a strong faith in God as a nonconformist in England. By the time he was 16, he had gone through 3 or 4 fleeting and partial reformations. During his sea voyage in 1748, he had read Thomas a Kempis's The Imitation of Christ once and began to read it again on March 9th. This time, as he read it, he asked himself, "What if these things should be true?" He woke that night to a violent storm. To make a long story short, they were adrift at sea for 4 weeks, during which time he read parts of the New Testament and began to cry out to the Lord. By the end of that time, Newton had recovered his belief in the God and his grace. But you see how there was nothing instantaneous about the conversion. Why am I telling you these things? Some of you may be even discouraged by them if I'm not careful, but my purpose is to bring encouragement. How? I'm a realist, so it's a good thing that God's reality is ultra cool and glorious. The fact that even the most rapid and dramatic conversions we know of are not nearly as rapid and instantaneous as we think tells us a lot about this reality of God's. It's in understanding God's reality better that I find immense divine encouragement. Do you remember those 4 questions I said were good ones to ask of every Bible passage? What, you've forgotten already? You can't see it, but I have a look of mock shock on my face. Number 1, what does the passage teach me about God? Number 2, what does the passage teach me about myself? Number 3, what does the passage teach me about what God has done and is doing to me? And fourth and finally, what does the passage teach me about how I should respond to God? The fact that conversions aren't normally rapid or instantaneous things, even in the best cases, tells me first of all that sin is a much harder thing than we imagine. This is our first mistake. We routinely diminish the sins in our lives through a myriad of means. We ignore them, conveniently forget them, shrink them down to the size of a freckle, mutate them into normalcy, and employ dozens of other neuro-linguistic programming tricks. First, we should understand how evil and how hard sin is. Next, we learn something about ourselves. We learn that we are sinful, see point 1 above. We learn that we are helpless without God, and that our salvation is all from Him. We learn that God works in our lives in many ways, often before we're even aware of it. But we continue to commit what I call the empirical heresy, which is to allow ourselves to be deceived into believing that something is only real if I can perceive it. But mostly, we learn about God. We learn how patient God is in dealing with our sins without killing us. We learn how gracious He is in giving to us what we need and could not otherwise have. And we learn that His love is stronger than sin. I find encouragement also in this, that my joy and thankfulness aren't dependent on what I've done, but on what God is doing. If someone doesn't convert despite my most eloquent and impassioned pleas, why is my eye evil? Isn't it supposed to be about God and not me? And if someone does convert, why do I fall into heresy and blasphemy, believing that it is me and not God who has done this? I'm in this thing for the long haul, this business of making disciples of Jesus Christ. I vowed to spend 18 years and more on each of my 6 kids, training each one to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, and to spend the rest of my life working on discipling my wife and myself. I'm in it until I finish writing the Give Us This Day for every single passage in the New Testament, and until as many of you have read them as desire. And then I'm in it for whatever else God asks me to do. I vowed to give my entire life to God with no strings attached. I vowed to water, plant, fertilize, mow, weed, till, de-rockify, and nurture whoever I can with no certainty of reward, other than that I am pleasing to my Master. So whether I persuade the Herod Agrippas II in my life a little, or whether they mock me for thinking I could so quickly persuade them, or whether my own children seem like little reprobates at times, I know these things, that sin is hideously ugly and frightfully immense, that I am a sinner who has received the grace of God, and that God's grace and love beat Satan and sin any day of the week.
Give Us This Day Evening Edition is a presentation of Always with Christ Radio in the Anglican Way.